Hi, everyone. This is Holly Herndon.
I'm Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to
Interdependence.
If you're hearing this, then you're listening to the shorter free version. If you're enjoying what we're doing and would like to hear the full episode, please visit patreon.com/interdependence and become a patron. Since Matt and I first started thinking about doing a podcast, we imagined starting a thread of conversations with fiction authors and artists that in many ways touch on some of the issues that we might be exploring in other conversations. And so today we're thrilled to kick off this direction with a conversation with Tim Maughan, the author of Infinite Detail, winner of The Guardian's Best Science Fiction and Fantasy Book of 2019, and a gripping and prescient work that explores the simple question, what would happen if the internet stopped working? In this conversation, we discuss sailing on a cargo ship off the coast of China, the 21st century skills of reading how invisible networks dictate many aspects of our lives, conservatism and relevancy in science fiction, and how the book economy works and could work better. Tim is a generous and funny guest. We hope you enjoy. Ring, 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 ring.
Hey, Tim.
Hi.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
We're good.
Good. Very happy to be speaking with you.
That was unnaturally jovial hey for me, I have to say.
Do you mind just introducing yourself for our dear listeners?
Yeah, sure. I'm Tim Maughan. I'm a writer and novelist from the UK originally, currently based in Ottawa in Canada. I write nonfiction and journalism stuff, but also a lot of fiction. My debut novel, Infinite Detail, was out last year.
Amazing. Yeah, we definitely want to talk about Infinite Detail. But before we do so, I just wanted to talk to you briefly about Before you released your, this is a debut novel, right? Infinite Detail? It's a debut?
It is, yeah.
Right. So before you released this novel, you were writing, you were kind of more in a journalistic role slash kind of like short story science fiction, if that's correct. And one example of that I found really interesting was, could we blow up the internet? And that seemed to be kind of research for your book, Infinite Detail. And I really liked how you were able to find kind of two outlets for a similar kind of subject. One, a more kind of, research journalistic outlet, and the other kind of creative fiction. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So, yeah, it's funny, actually, because it's kind of the opposite of that in some ways. I actually was writing fiction before I became like in very much in inverted commas, like a journalist. Right. And because I don't necessarily consider myself a journalist. I mean, I am a journalist. I've even won like journalism awards in the past, but I don't have any training in that. And I don't like have any kind of formal background in it, which makes me very like slightly insecure about calling myself it a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. I actually was writing fiction, like writing short fiction. I started writing short fiction about 10, 12 years ago in the UK. And I actually got asked to do journalism based off some short fiction that people, some editors had read.
Okay.
And then I just kind of fell into being a journalist at that point and kind of like a madman quit my job and just been trying to do both writing fiction and journalism like freelance as my only source of income, which was fucking insane, but I did it. I had written some pieces of fiction. I had actually another book out previously. This Infinite Detail is my debut novel, but I had a small collection of short stories that I self-published that came out in 2011. And that got a little bit of attention. Some people picked up on it. Coy Doctorow picked up on it and wrote about it in Boing Boing. And a writer whose work I just have always really admired for years, Simon Ings, he's a writer in the UK. I sent him a copy just because I was a fan. I said, you know, and he read it and really enjoyed it and came back and asked me to write. He was at the time working for New Scientist magazine in the UK. And they were launching a futures and science fiction offshoot magazine, kind of like a literary magazine. Mm-hmm. Called Arc, which was amazing. It's just they only ran for four issues, like it was quarterly, and they only did it for a year, unfortunately. And it had, he said, would you write me a piece of fiction to go in that? And I like some of the people he had write for them were incredible, like Margaret Atwood and Bruce Sterling, just incredible.
Crazy.
Jeff Vandermeer, just incredible cool. names. And I was like, yeah, there's no, I mean, I was a nobody. Nobody knew who the hell I was. There's no way I was going to turn that down. So I did that. And off the back of that, we just developed a working relationship, me and New Scientist, where he would ask me to go and cover, because he was the culture editor. He was the arts editor for New Scientist. Right? He used to run Culture Lab there. I don't believe he's there anymore. I haven't talked to him for a while. But he would send me off. I was living in Bristol at the time. So he would, if there were art events that looked interesting to New Scientist, he would send me off to cover those in Bristol. And then shortly after that, I moved to New York, and they made me like a contributing editor for Culture Lab in New York. So I was doing a lot of writing for them. But around about the same time as well, so that was starting in 2011. I moved to New York in 2013. 2014, I did this big trip to China with Liam Young. And I came back and I wrote about that stuff for the BBC, which is then suddenly I was a journalist. but again, all this stuff I kind of sort of fell into by accident. Really, the piece you mentioned, Holly, about can we destroy, can we blow up the internet? That was actually written to promote the novel. That was a piece that came out just before or just after, I can't remember now, the launch of the novel. And that's the thing, you know, that publishing's awful, man. But it's the sort of thing that authors are meant to do. They're meant to write op-ed pieces or essays in large publications, right, to garner interest for the books when they came out. And I'd written for Motherboard quite a bit before that. I mean, I'd been writing for Motherboard on and off for years. And so I just went to editors on it and said, hey, would you be interested in a piece in this? And they were like, yeah, sure. So that was kind of where that came from. So that was weird, actually, because you said about the research and stuff, and I had to do more research for that article than I did for the novel. I like had just guessed at stuff in the novel. I had a vague implication. But my approach to... That's a whole other conversation about world building and stuff, which is a word that doesn't sit very happily with me a lot of the time. But my approach to a lot of this stuff when it comes to writing science fiction is I will go away and do a lot of research on my own, or I'll sit and think about how, say, the interface on a pair of augmented reality glasses works in like really intricate detail for like maybe a year. I'll be thinking of it, looking stuff, doing research. But I don't necessarily, I mean, I have that stuff in my head when I'm writing, but I don't necessarily drop it into the book, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like stuff you drop little hints at, but I'm not interested in writing the kind of science fiction where somebody sits down and explains to you what the internet is, or somebody sits down and explains to you how these augmented reality goggles work. Do you know what I mean? I'm not into that kind of exposition heavy sci-fi. It doesn't really interest me.
There's an affinity to what you're doing with that, I think, with what we're doing. I mean, we wrote Proto and did a lot of research that went into that, but then I also wrote my dissertation on a similar subject, and a lot of that research came after Proto, and so right. It felt like in order to put kind of words on paper in that kind of way, outside of a kind of fictional world, I felt like I had to have kind of like hard quotes and facts and things to kind of back it up, and I didn't have, you know, and so it's, I think that's an interesting kind of relationship that you have between those two kind of outputs. I'm really curious if, you know, given that the news cycle is so intense right now, is it really difficult as a novelist to kind of compete with the acceleration of the news cycle and the kind of, yeah, ever increasing kind of stakes of the attention economy in a way?
Oh boy. Just, you know, it's like, I where to start, man? It's always been a tough one for me because I made this really stupid, but I mean, I say stupid, but for me, it's exciting, like deliberate decision to write very near future fiction for the time being, to write very near future fiction. I'm interested in using science fiction as a tool to look at current trends and then extrapolate what might happen in 5 years. Like, you know, people talk about near fiction in science fiction, they usually mean less than 100 years. It's stuff that happens in the current century. And things that are called new fiction are sometimes set in like the 2070s or something like that. I want to write stuff literally set in the 2020s. I'm kind of very excited about the idea of writing science fiction about what's happening right now. So, yeah, that's fucking hard right now, to be honest. It's incredibly hard right now because this is one of the first times in my, again, in inverted commas, career, like, where I've had trouble seeing past the current bump of what might happen. And I not wanting to bring the tone down, like the mood down, like super quickly, I can see what might be, especially in regards to America, I could see what might happen in the next few years, and it's really bad. And I don't like, and you know what I mean? And it's just kind of that in itself is kind of like, for once, I'm not sure I want to be writing about stuff that people are actually living through, because what they're living through is bad enough. And they probably don't need, a lot of people don't need the badness pointed out to them, which is usually my job in some ways. In some ways, is to take the situation that people understand and are familiar with and go and pick away and go, look, this is actually terrible, because it might not be affecting you this way, but it's affecting other people this way. There's a very large chance that a lot of people are going to be affected in very bad ways in the next few years, especially in America, from the outcome of everything that's happening at the moment. I'm kind of like, I don't know. I don't know that anybody... It's a hard sell anyway, just from a commercial point of view, to make people... People are very actively, especially in science fiction, looking for escapism, and I really don't deliver that. So that's a hard sell anyway. Right now, it's like, I don't even know if I want to be doing it, because it's like, people are really, really in the shit right now. It's weird that, like, a science fiction writer whose work I really like a few weeks ago tweeted that he'd cancelled the book because he'd scrapped a book he was working on because it was the news. It was too close to the news.
Oh, wow.
And it's weird because I cancelled two books in the last few months that I'd started because they weren't close enough to the news. it's like... I've kind of written myself into this corner in a certain way, and I have to kind of live with it. But it's, and I'm not regretful of that. I don't want to sound regretful of that. It's weird.
It's weird, right? Because it's, I think we end up in this situation a little bit too, right? Where, like, in many cases, I mean, I can say personally, like, I'm certainly not a journalist. I'm certainly not a writer even, but, like, as a result of research interests that just kind of come together through creative projects, you end up in some cases with information that you can then ratify that does put you in that realm of, like, nonfiction. And in fact, I think there's a whole category, I think, of, like, contemporary artists of the last 10 years who, through wanting to respond to the world around them, somehow end up on nuggets that have journalistic or nonfiction value, right? Because in a sense, they're coming at it from an oblique angle, and then they might stumble across some information that's actually highly relevant. And I wonder, I mean, the question of responsibility in that case does become really interesting, right? Because, I mean, you don't want to necessarily tether the creative process too much to events happening in the world, right? There has to be some kind of liberty for creative license or whatnot. But it is quite a perilous kind of this near-term window that you're dealing with is quite perilous.
Plus, given the timescale of writing a novel and releasing it, I mean, it must be...
Absolutely, yeah,
it must
yeah.
be, it's probably even worse than a record, I can
absolutely,
imagine.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Oh, it's crazy, dear. That you know, I mean, I was writing this book for close to 7 years.
Oh, wow.
But mainly because I was doing a lot of other stuff at the same time. It wasn't like I'm writing a book at the moment, which hopefully will be done in a few months. So it's not just that I'm a slow writer, which I can be a very slow writer, but it's more that other shit was going on. I would get distracted. I'd leave it from, there's times on this book where I left it untouched for like nearly a year. Towards the end of writing, I kind of took a few months out of doing everything else, and just because it was depressing me that I hadn't finished it, and just got it done. But yeah, it's that process is long as well. I mean, from the moment I got an agent to the book coming out was over 2 years.
Right? So crazy.
That is crazy. That would drive me insane.
Well, it's an interesting tension as well, right? Between, like, the urge for timeliness, which is basically the attention economy, and then the urge for timelessness, which in a sense... I mean, timelessness in music too, I feel, often in a way is kind of an invitation to make very conservative decisions or quite hacky decisions, right? And, like, that tension, I guess, like, so long as that tension's, like, a problem, you're probably on the right path. So you're not just trying to make something timely just to kind of get attention, right? But I mean, yeah, I mean, because we definitely, like, go around with this where it's, like, it's not for opportunistic reasons that we might be dealing with an issue that happens to be relevant for the coming years or whatever. But if you don't deal with that, you can get into kitsch, you know.
Yeah. And people see that a little bit. I think people have been in the science fiction community. I've kind of hinted towards the sort of work I do in this kind of being opportunistic, which is hilarious to me. I mean, there's a I wrote an essay about this for 1-0, like at the beginning of the year, and there's a theme that I've been kind of, so that you're talking about relevancy, right? The term that they use in science fiction all the time is dated. Right. And they use this as a very negative term. And people say that to me about my work. They look at it and go, aren't you worried this is going to be dated in a few years? Or they look at Asimov and go, well, Asimov is great, but a lot of his stuff is dated, or whoever. You know, I see people saying about Neuromancer, Gibson works is great, but it's dated because he didn't predict cell phones or whatever. And to me, that when my obsession is taking that word dated and turning it from a negative thing into a positive thing. The idea that you can look at, a science fiction novel or any work of art, but specifically a science fiction book, and say, this is dated, good. That means it's of its time, right? All science fiction is about the time in which it's written. Anybody else telling you anything else is just lying to you.
Well, there's also this kind of, I feel like there's also this obsession with different medium, as like this happens in music as well, is kind of like decontextualizing where a sound or where a work comes from, like the community that it comes from. I know, exactly. Like it is situated in its time.
It's like literally, like, you know, my obsession is Detroit techno. I love the music and I love the visceral, immediate, like, emotional reaction of hearing it. But so much of that is tied up to me in understanding the context of where and when it was made. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's the same with, you know, the other music I loved, with Jungle, with Chicago House, with everything. The part of the fascination and the obsession with these music for me is understanding the cultures where this came out of, understanding the gay clubs in Chicago, or understanding, warehouse parties in Detroit, or tower block pirate radio stations in London. All that stuff this is the most exciting stuff about this, right? And at my age, I also run into that problem where it starts to sound like nostalgia the more I talk about it. But I kind of allow myself to come to terms with that a little bit. And appreciate that nostalgia in some ways.
I would say, in a way, though, I think, again, that the nostalgic thing, though, to give you credit, because I'd also share that, I think there's a difference between, fetishizing specific forms and wanting to kind of revive particular forms versus fetishizing. I mean, this is my very pseudoscientific take on this, but I'm convinced you can hear it. I'm convinced you can hear where music was made for a room of people to dance to. I genuinely think you can hear that. And so I don't think necessarily that being reverent of musics that are made in that context is nostalgic per se. It just so happens that there was maybe more of that in a time when, culture was less stratified and less immaterial.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. And I think, I kind of literally hinted at that in the book. There's a line in the book where there's discussion listening to an old Jungle mixtape and about being able to hear the room. Because you can hear the rooms in those old vinyl recorded mixtapes, right? Because you can literally hear the room because the vibration is coming back through the stylus, right?
Yep.
And you can hear that atmosphere, right? It's very subtle, but it's there. It's kind of like some ghostly reverb over the whole track. So yeah, I was kind of like very consciously kind of wanted to touch on that. But also with me, it's very much a kind of, and the book, this is in the book a little bit as well, maybe a lot in the book actually, if I'm honest, but there's the kind of Mark Fisher hauntology kind of thing as well going on with that kind of, it's a nostalgia, but for lost possibilities. It's a nostalgia for like lost futures, which is, might be all nostalgia in some ways is like that, but at the time, right now in the present moment, it's a slightly darker, more serious thing to talk about, because we are looking at a time of lost futures, right? We are looking at, I mean, my hauntology for the rave scene and the failure of the UK rave scene to become more of an established political movement is one thing, and it's a very real, it's a very very real hauntology and regret in that some ways, but But there's also, you know, for kids today, but for, you know, people growing up today, there's this very, there's this very real feeling, which I'm trying to get my head around as an older guy. I'm trying to understand this in as much as I can, this very real, like, what's the future now? Like, you know, if you understand how climate change works, or you understand how capitalism works, these are two systems that are, you know, the environment and the global markets, which are undoubtedly doomed to fail in the next 20 years. And it's like, how do you talk about futures then? And how do you have nostalgia for art that's about futures then, when you literally don't have futures? So it's not that you don't have futures, but futures you can imagine are very hard. And stuff's kind of tied up in it a little bit as well, I think.
I wonder if it's worth just giving a kind of brief overview of what the book is about for those who haven't read it, without kind of giving away any spoilers or anything. We'll definitely link to the book in the show notes, but just so that people can understand what we're talking about.
Because the elevator pitch for the book is, what would happen if the internet disappeared? Now, what would happen if we destroyed the internet, and why would we want to destroy it? And that's basically what the book is. The book's set across two time zones, two eras, like they're just labeled in the book before and after. And the before books are set in what I kind of consider to be an alternate present. So it's kind of very much the early 2020s. Mm-hmm. Technology is basically the same, apart from augmented reality has kind of replaced smartphones. So people wear augmented reality glasses as much as instead of smartphones, but those are ubiquitous as smartphones. And it's a time of like very concentrated surveillance capitalism, exactly as we're living through now at the moment. So people are heavily monitored, their data's mined, AI systems are emerging that are problematic in various ways. People feel oppressed by the internet as much as they feel freed by it, which I think is something that probably most people would agree with these days. That's what's happening before, and then after, set 10 years later, there's been some kind of cyber attack, not wanting to give too much away, but some kind of event has caused the internet to disappear. And then 10 years later, we're looking at what that looks like, very specifically to Bristol in the UK, and very specifically to a neighbourhood in Bristol in the UK, and how that lack of the internet has played out, how the supply chains collapsed, how the infrastructure's collapsed, how the healthcare's collapsed, how culture has collapsed, right? Our digital memories now, everything have disappeared. Right? And very specifically, I wanted to base it around the after stuff around this one neighborhood, Stokes Croft in Bristol, because the thing that struck me about this destruction of the internet is how we would go very, very quickly, like instantaneously almost, from a global culture to a hyper-local culture. Right? Mm-hmm. Like the characters in Infinite Detail living in Stokes Cross, they don't know what's happening in London. They don't know what's happening in Bath, and sometimes they don't know what's happening in the other neighbourhoods of Bristol. Right? Because the implication being that when the internet goes down, it just doesn't wipe out your email or everything. It wipes out major infrastructures. Like, yeah, your landlines, your cell phones don't work. Your landlines wouldn't work anymore. And most landlines, the few landlines that remain, have gone over to being voice over IP in the last 10 years. Right, so the internet goes, it's actually using the landlines basically like making a Skype call now. So like all that stuff was kind of there as a way of me wanting to unpick the issues we face now from surveillance, but also our over-reliance on infrastructures that we don't understand and don't control, and just kind of picking that apart, and also to make some commentary about revolutions and uprisings and how they fail if they're not planned and organized, if that makes sense. There's a very, very excellent Astra Taylor essay that I read just as I was coming to the end of writing the book that really helped me secure the ending of the book. It was very helpful. I've thanked her every time I get the opportunity to, I thank her for it. And it's about how the difference between activism and organizing.
Yeah.
And I think really that's ends up being the core of the book. This, you know, it's easy for us to hashtag things and shout about things and even maybe go on a march occasionally. All those things are very important and they should be done. But at the same time, that's not being an organizer, and organizers are actually in this for a long time. If you're an organizer, then you do you work at community level or you devote a certain part of your life, if not all your life, to a cause for like 10, 20 years. It's not something you go on one march about and then that's magically made you an organizer or an activist. It's a really excellent essay. And it's something that I think is super relevant at the moment. And I think people are seeing this. I think people in New York and other cities, Atlanta, other cities in the US have seen this in the last few weeks. People went out on marches and they're still going out on marches. It's fucking incredible and amazing to watch, despite everything that happened. There were still nightly Black Lives Matter large marches in New York, and a lot of people are going.
Yep.
Are going on them. It's not being covered by the media, but you see it on Twitter, not just with people tweeting it, but you see it from the MTA making announcements about the bridges being closed, right? And things like this. As soon as the cops stopped beating people up, as much the media companies disappeared. So sorry, I'm not wanting to go on the rant about that, but like, yeah.
I think actually, can we stick on that for a second? Because one of the things Holly and I were chatting just for a second beforehand, you just reminded me of it a little bit with the MTA, which is that when you're dealing with certain themes, particularly pertaining to infrastructure, which, you know, can often come across as like a rather dusty conversation or a dusty topic. Would you say in some senses that it's almost a 21st century skill to be able to read signals on that kind of infrastructural or organizational level, right? Like, I remember in some of the stuff that Holly shared with me prior, you know, you talked about how the trip on the shipping container in China was incredibly informative to you, just to become aware of these kind of higher order transnational processes that were happening, that ultimately the individuals involved in maybe steering the ship or, you know, transporting the pallet, we're kind of beholden to. And I saw in some ways kind of a comparison with, there's a friend of ours, Sahail Malik at Goldsmiths, who's done a lot of work on like high frequency trading, right? That like,
right.
In many cases you have these quite abstract systems that a lot of the people who build them don't even know how they work. Where if you can follow those kind of, if you can read those kind of infrastructural signals, in some ways you have like a far closer idea for, number one, what's actually happening and what might end up happening. And number two, where the pain points are for big infrastructure, right? Like where, if you were to make, if you were to have revolutionary ideals or so on and so forth, actually, you know, one might be able to more accurately determine where to hit, so to speak, not physically, but, you know, as a result of learning the 21st century skill of being aware of these, of the stack. Would you say that's fair?
Yes, and like
I'm playing to the crowd here, Tim.
You're on the verge of triggering one of my massive rants. You're right. I think you're largely exactly right, Matt. What do they say on the internet when they do a horrible man thread? Buckle up, right? It's kind of so. my obsession with this is. First off, I should say Adam Curtis, for all his faults, did a much better job of explaining this in Hypernormality, that movie, that last major film of his. But this theory, okay, I'll start with a little anecdote, which is the anecdote I always use for this. I was on the container ship, like you mentioned, right? So I did this trip to China with some friends of mine, Liam Young and Kate Davis, as speculative architects and filmmakers. And I work with Liam a lot on making short films over the years, but they were going on this trip to China, this supply chain trip to China. They'd done it once before, in fact, but they were going another time. They've taken some students with them as a kind of field trip, and they invited me to come along. And it was like we spent a week on a container ship in South China Seas, left from Korea, ended up in Shenzhen. And then we spent about another 2.5 weeks in China, traveling mainly overland trains and stuff, looking at manufacturing and stuff in China, ended up in Inner Mongolia looking at rare earth extraction and processing. We're in this awful 5 mile across toxic lake of radioactive slush, which is like the byproduct of making magnets and the stuff that's used to polish smartphone screens and stuff like that. But anyway, so that's a whole other story, right? So, and it's a kind of like this amazing trip. You spend the first week on this container ship, which is the most, these ports are incredible, these huge container ports. than the most science fictional thing you've ever seen. The scale of them is insane. It just feels like you suddenly realize you're part of this, like, really, this huge Apollo moonshot style project, right, that wraps the world in this kind of infrastructure. And then the legs up part of the trip, you're in these sweatshops seeing Christmas decorations being made by teenagers. And you're like, oh, right, so we built this huge, incredible feat of engineering just so we can exploit cheap labor on the other side of the world. And it's kind of, and it's a really kind of like depressing thing when it hits you. Mm-hmm. But one thing that happened to me on that trip, I was on the container ship one afternoon. I can remember it very vividly. I was sat on the bridge and I was chatting to the captain of the ship, right? And we were talking and there was this beeping sound. And he said, hang on a second. And he ran over to a computer, just like this beige box PC, you know, computer that was sat on the bridge, and he tapped away at the keyboard a little bit. Came back, picked up the phone, called the engine room, told them to slow the ship down, got back, put the phone down, walked over to me, started talking to me again. And I went, hang on. I meant to be here to find out what's happening. Like, what just happened? What was that? What was that? Just, and he said, oh, I had an email from Maersk. This was a Maersk ship. We had an email from their headquarters in Copenhagen telling me to slow the ship down. And I said, why? He said, I don't know. And I was like, what do you mean you don't know? I said, what do you mean you don't know? And he said, they don't tell me. He said, there's an automated email. And I was like, right. And he said, well, what it probably means is that there's a traffic jam at the next port, or maybe there's a traffic jam on the road outside the port, which means that, you know, we're not going to be able to get into a berth, and so we're not going to be able to offload our boxes and pick up new boxes. So getting there at the speed we're getting there would just be inefficient, just be a waste of fuel. We might as well slow down and get there in time for when there's a berth over. I said, oh, okay. And then my head started to spin, right? And I suddenly, you know, that gif with the woman and the formula all appearing around her head. And I was suddenly like, wait, what's happening? And I suddenly realized, and I'd been piecing this stuff together throughout the trip, but this was kind of the example that really brought it home for me, is that this is a vast, complicated, mainly automated network, and the people working with it don't understand it. And even the people who have got the responsibility of like running something as high in the chain as running a container ship with 10,000 containers on it, yeah, right? This vast, vast thing they don't understand, and it's not explained to them. And decisions have been made algorithmically on literally the other side of the world. And even on top of that, there's extra layers to this. Like, so we had internet on the ship. It was really crappy and really slow. I wasn't expecting to have it. I was kind of disappointed when we had it, to be honest. But, you know, and you'd walk around, and the crew, who were lovely, just the loveliest people, who are mainly from the Philippines and South India, were kind of like, at night when they were off duty or whatever, they'd be sat in the corridors with their laptops trying to get the best Wi-Fi connection so they could Facebook their family and all this stuff, you know. And I ended up doing that, sitting with them in the corridor at the secret magical spots where the Wi-Fi was the best and stuff. And I said to the captain, I said, you know, I'm surprised there's Wi-Fi on the ship. You know, I'm surprised we've got internet on the ship. He goes, yeah, it's satellite. It's very, very slow. But it's not really there for us. And I was like, well, what do you mean? He said, well, it's there for the reefers. And on the container ship, they have these refrigerated containers called reefers. And I could go into a whole thing about this, so stop me if I'm going on too long. But they're these they're computer-controlled, climate-controlled refrigerated containers. And so they're very, very precise. And one example is, say, bananas. So you pick bananas in the Caribbean somewhere. You pick them while they're still, before they've ripened, off the trees when they're still green. You put them in one of these refrigerated containers. That refrigerated container takes them all the way to, say, your local Lidl in Berlin. They stay in the same container. But on the process of that, the container knows exactly where it is in the world using GPS. It alters, and exactly when it's going to arrive at your Lidl, it alters the climate in there to slowly artificially ripen those bananas so they're ripe when they arrive.
Wow.
And so the internet on the ship is, all these reefers are plugged into the internet on the ship, and actually the main responsibility for the crew, which is only about 20 on this huge ship, their main responsibility is to make sure the reefers don't malfunction. When the reefer malfunctions, it doesn't tell the captain, it emails Copenhagen, it emails the same network, who then sends an email to the captain, who then tells a member of his crew to go and fix it. Right? So the internet was there purely for the reefers to talk to other reefers and to the network. Right? So the humans are kind of just like back, like getting a piggybacking, sorry, my words, just like piggybacking off this network that was meant for shipping containers to talk to each other. Mm-hmm. It's just absolutely crazy. But what I started to realize through this, to get to my point and to get to what you were saying, Matt, is this kind of idea that we have already handed over so much control about how the world works to automated systems without realizing. So supply chains are part as much part of the global economy as the high frequency trading you were talking about. Like, right? These are things, the flow of goods, physical goods, the flow of physical capital, the flow of digital capital around the world is what runs countries and runs economies. So much of that is just not in the control of politicians anymore. Right? You can be Obama and you can run the greatest, most optimistic campaign in American history, you know. Hope and change campaign, right? That yes, we can stuff. But when you get into power, the reality is that you don't actually have a lot of control. You don't have a lot of control over how things work. You don't even necessarily have a lot of control over, you know, like, it's hard for you to even clamp down on something like police brutality, right? But it's certainly very hard for you to make big economic changes. Those things are actually very hard for leaders to do. And I think over a period of 20, 30 years, as we slowly, not always slowly, but we rapidly, I guess, automated our economies and our supply chains and so many other aspects of how systems and infrastructure that affect us work, is we took power away from politicians. And we created the illusion, not an illusion, but we created the concept, which is incredibly rife, especially in American politics, but certainly in European politics. We could create the impression that politicians, not that they don't have power, but that they can't, they don't use power, or they're lazy, or they're ineffectual, or they're corrupt, or they're corporate stooges, which often they are corporate stooges, especially in America. But that they're not, they say they're going to change things, and then when they get in, nothing changes. And I think this is, whether you're on the left or the right, I think this is a very powerful concept, especially in American politics. And it has created this huge distrust in politicians and politics itself, to the extent, you know, saying something is political is a bad thing to do in the US. And more importantly, I think this is directly led, I feel like part of this, lots of other like every complex, and I'm talking about complex systems, so it's ironic that I'm simplifying it as much as I am, but I think this is a really important factor in why Trump got elected and why Brexit happened. I think they both came at times where a certain part of the electorate was so dismayed with a lack of change. It might not be the change that I want, it might not be the change that other people want, but certainly a lack of change, an idea that status quo was corrupt or was powerless, weak, that they turned to strongman.
One thing that I think that you really successfully capture in your writing is the kind of the impact on the individual, or like the kind of average person within these larger, often dystopian systems. One review I was reading referred to your writing as kitchen sink dystopia, which I mean, I love the kind of kitchen sink genre. So that's like kind of close to my heart. But I read another short story that you read called Flyover Country. I'll put a link to that one as well. But I really like that because it's a really good example of kind of following the downtrodden individual struggling through the harsh realities of a dystopian scene, rather than a kind of, I don't know, punk savior or corporate boss antihero that we often mm-hmm. find right. in a lot of the cyberpunk right. writing. Right. So I wonder if you want to say anything about that, like kind of talking about your kind of like, yeah, average person living within these larger dystopian systems.
I'm also going to jump on that. Oh, sorry. Oh.
No, go ahead.
No, I'm just going to jump on that really quickly. Actually, one of my favorite filmmakers, have you ever seen the films of Shawshank?
Remind me of the film. Remind me of
He did Platform was a big one. He did a film called Still Life, which is possibly one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen. But it's actually really, really compelling. I know you're going to freak out about it. Basically, short preamble just to communicate my enthusiasm for this person, but he comes from a tradition. He was basically a Chinese radical filmmaker that was an amongst a group of filmmakers that were heavily persecuted, actually. And he kind of figured out very early that in some ways you could make incredibly critical films by kind of advertising the ascendant insane infrastructure that was being built in China. This is from the 90s to the present day.
This was his kind of workaround censorship.
Well, exactly. So his films are funded to like an insane level. I mean, they're gorgeous and like epic.
Well, because they also show the countryside.
Well, exactly. They're funded kind of by the tourist bureau, but everything is framed. Everything is framed through the experience of often, you know, rural Chinese workers who are then transported to a shipping port. And in a sense, there's actually in Still Life, not the spoiler alert, but there's this insane moment where, you know, this person who basically has left their family behind is a low wage worker, is at the port, and a spaceship takes off. And it's one of these beautiful kind of like almost like magical realist moments in which he uses, you know, the spaceship to kind of illustrate just how alien the shipping networks that you're talking about must seem. Is being dragged from, you know, dragged 50, 100 years by just taking a train, you know. Anyway, I don't want to, it just came to mind. And I think it speaks to the kitchen sink.
It sounds great. And I'll have a look at that. It just reminded me of being on a train in China to Inner Mongolia. I think we were leaving Shanghai. It was a 26-hour train journey.
It was
very, very beautiful, very high tech, nicer than any train I've ever been on before. But it would, and we were trying to sleep, obviously. And I remember every time you wake up, there were different people on the train because it was stopping here and there. I woke up one point and opened my eyes, and right like a foot from my face was an elderly Chinese man who was leaning over the back of his seat and just staring at me. And when I looked around, the train was full of people who were standing room only for this part of the journey, and they were just staring at me and the other white people on the train. And then I realized what's going on. They've never seen white people before flesh.
I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, okay. Even on this train line, which is this kind of like almost bullet train level futuristic train line, there was this part of rural China where people were taking short journeys on the same train, and they just weren't used to seeing white people. They'd seen white people obviously on TV and shit, but you know. What you just described kind of reminded me of that. What was the? Oh, so we talk about kitchen sink dystopia, so the term kitchen sink dystopia. I think Brendan Byrne, who's a really good friend of mine, started calling my work everyday dystopia at some point. And then Madeline Ashby, I think she coined the phrase kitchen sink dystopia for her own work as well as some of mine. Mm-hmm. I was never sure about the kitchen sink part and I might be wrong, that kind of, with me, it sounds very bougie. It sounds very suburban, and you know,
I always thought kitchen sink was very working class, because I think of Ken Loach films.
So Ken Loach is a huge influence on me, and that kind of work is a huge influence. See, Brendan, bless him, he called me more a social realist than a science fiction writer, I'm kind of like aiming for that to a certain extent in my work. But what you were saying, Holly, about, you know, the punk rebel revolutionary hacker, that doesn't interest me anymore, right? It's not. Yeah. I've got characters that think they're that in my book, but they're not actually that, right? Do you know what I mean?
I
wanted to play with that deliberately. I wanted to play with that deliberately, right? You know, part of the point of the book is these people could be really dangerous if they don't fucking organize and work out what they're doing, right?
I actually really love how you write about the hacker groups, because in some ways, I mean, it hits so close to home with my own experience with different, you know, communities, and it comes across as if you have also had really close relationships in those kind of communities, because it feels very kind of like playful and tongue in cheek, and almost like you need kind of an intimate knowledge of those communities to be able to criticize in that kind of playful way.
Yes and no. So I'm one of these people, I'm constantly on the periphery of communities. I'm not a sort of great community person, to be honest. I understand them and I appreciate them. Whenever I start getting into a community, whether that's the techno community or like the futures community or the hacking community or the science fiction community, which is, good God, the one I try and stay the furthest from, if I'm honest, I always end up feeling out of place and weirdly resentful. And so I kind of, but I love community stuff. I mean, as an observer, as kind of like, this is going to sound so pretentious, I'm kind of flaneur kind of approach to community. So I like to walk around them and look at them rather than kind of be like involved in them. And I'm sure, like, you know, I have some overlap with you guys. You know, I speak at MuTech every year since I've moved up to Canada. And, you know, I've been to, you know, ADE, and I've talked to ADE, and I've talked at, like, you know, art events in Europe and stuff, and Berlin. And you, like, you know, these people are fascinating, the work's fascinating, but at the same time, I'm like, oh, I don't want to be too involved with these hipsters all the time. So I like to be on the periphery of those things. And I think that gives me an ability to sort of snarkily talk about them in gentle ways. But yeah, I would.
If you're hearing this, then you're listening to the shorter free version. If you're enjoying what we're doing and would like to hear the full episode, please visit patreon.com/interdependence and become a patron.